Okay, so we took a week off there. Eric was kind enough to fill in while I was away. But just to kind of refresh in our minds, Deuteronomy really takes place from one location. They're right here near the foot of Mount Nebo. In fact, that Mount Nebo, the view from there is the upper picture from the introductory slide. And as Moses is nearing the end of his part of the journey of the Israelites, he is reiterating to them, this new generation, their responsibilities to obey God. He's reminding them of the failures of the previous generation so that they cannot make those same mistakes, and giving further instruction as to remember what type of people you are to be and how you are to act when you go in and take the land, because Moses is not going with them. And so since Moses isn't, this is his final opportunity to get these ideas across to a new generation that did not sit at the feet of Mount Sinai when all of the original events happened as they left Egypt. These were they either weren't there or they were very young at the time for most of them. And so here from this location where they will eventually cross over the Jordan River to Jericho, which is right there, the final stages of their preparation are happening. And we have been in the second of three sermons that he gives, three different speeches that he gives to the nation. The second one is by far the bulk of the book. The first one is, you know, four chapters there. The last one is four chapters. But the middle one covers, you know, about 20, 21 chapters, 22 chapters, something like that. And we're right in the middle of that. The second one is really where Deuteronomy gets its name. Deuteronomy comes from two Greek words, deutero and nomos. Nomos meaning law, deutero meaning twice. So they're getting the law a second time. And so this second sermon or speech is that. It's primarily focused on here's laws that you may have already heard before, but I'm reiterating them to you. In this, there is sometimes given some added detail regarding those laws that we don't have from the previous books. So it's not entirely redundant, but there is a lot of covering things for a second time. And that does also allow us to cover this book a little bit faster, considering the fact that we've just finished the first four books of the Old Testament, and this should be fresher in our mind because of it. So we've covered up through chapter 11 at this point, where he looked at the Ten Commandments, and then the greatest commandment, what we call the greatest commandment. It actually isn't called that back in the Old Testament. He simply says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, your mind, your soul, and your strength. And we call it the greatest commandment because in the New Testament, that's what Jesus says is the first and greatest commandment, and the second being like it, love your neighbor as yourself. Chapter 7 focused primarily on their responsibility to entirely destroy the Canaanites. Don't let them linger on. Don't make any compromises. Don't destroy most of them and leave only the hard parts. And chapter 7 in many ways is quite a bit of foreshadowing, because that's all the stuff that they're going to actually do. They are going to take the land. They are going to win the victories over the Canaanites. They are going to invade and take over the area. But they are going to leave the little bits behind, and that's going to cause them nothing but problems down the road. There's really actually a lot of connections there that you and I as Christians can make with our own lives in terms of this idea of turning to God and serving God, but then what happens if you leave the corners of the house unclean? You know, the little bits of your life that you just kind of let linger on, those will tend to be the things that will cause you a great deal of problems. Then chapter 80 focused on the prosperity that they were soon to have. They are a group of people who's not had prosperity. They were slaves in Egypt. And then now as they moved in, into the wilderness, they have been living with the same supplies that they had all along. One of God's promises was that their shoes wouldn't wear out, which is a reasonable concern when there's no shoe store. They were out there in the wilderness for 40 years wearing the same shoes and living with the same general supplies. And so they're about to go somewhere where they're going to have wealth well beyond what they're used to. And that will have its own dangers. Then chapter 9 through chapter 11 focus primarily on this idea of not rebelling and the consequences of it. Chapter 11, you could sum up 9 through 11 by looking down at verse 26 of chapter 11, where it says in 11:26, "See, I'm setting before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing if you listen to the commandments of the Lord your God, which I am commanding you today, and the curse if you do not listen to the commands of the Lord your God, but turn aside from the way which I am commanding you today by following other gods which you have not known." That's really what he's laying out there in those three chapters there, is you have a choice. And you're going to have some choices to make when you go into this land and you have this new prosperity and you aren't wandering anymore, and there's these foreign people and they're going to have their foreign gods, and you're going to like some things that those gods have to offer. I know we wonder about that sometimes. Like, why is it that they would have Jehovah lead them in, perform all these great and mighty miracles, and yet they would somehow accept idols? Well, the reason is that the idols had things about them and their religious ways that were appealing. And that's always been the case. Idolatry inevitably appeals to things that are tempting, to lifestyles that we wish we could accept in the moment because they seem more permissive, or that they have an appeal to them of either a sense of entertainment or an appeal to the flesh or an appeal to our pride. So those false gods were going to be the same way. They were going to go into land and they were going to have religious ideas and rituals and habits that would have a certain appeal to them. He says, don't turn to those gods. You're going to have a choice. But if you do, I won't be with you. I'm a jealous God. And he said that multiple times, that they're not going to have the option of having their idols and him. God is elitist in that sense. He's very much exclusive through all the Old Testament and the New Testament. So then we move into chapter 12. And chapter 12 will deal with laws regarding the tabernacle. And in particular, focus on the fact that they are to worship God there. And one of the things that you find as we progress through the history of Israel is that God had some very specific injunctions regarding worship, that it wasn't to be done any way you wanted and anywhere you wanted. It was supposed to be done in a particular way at particular times. And sometimes even by particular people. There are certain acts of worship, such as making sacrifices, that not just anybody could do. You had to be a priest. And so chapter 12 lays out a lot of that, of where they're to do it and when they're to do it. And what you and I primarily can get from this is that it has always been the case where people have had a tendency to say, well, I'll worship God, but I'll worship him the way I want to. But God has never been pleased with that. When the Israelites do, in the end, fall to idolatry, one of the first things that will happen, in fact, we've already seen it once, which is when they're out in the wilderness and Moses is up on the mountaintop, they made that golden calf. But what did they say about the golden calf? They said, this is your God who did what? He led you out of Egypt. So they're going to worship the golden calf as if he's the God that made them. And that's the problem, is God has already made it clear, you're not to make any graven image of me. You're not supposed to make any sort of image of a beast and then worship and pretend it like it's me. And so they've already had this problem, and now as they go into the land, they're going to have it again. You'll have people who worship under every green tree and on every high hill will be the language that's used by the prophets to describe. It becomes a bit of a wild west of worship, where they, instead of being organized the way God intended and doing it the way that God meant, where they would go to the tabernacle and you would bring your sacrifice. In fact, there were specific rules of particularly things like tithing. You were supposed to tithe 10% of your beasts and of your harvest and everything. And God even made provisions for, well, what if you had to travel a long distance? Say, for example, you lived up in Nazareth, where Jesus would grow up, and you were going to go and bring your tithe down to the temple. Well, what are you going to do? You're going to bring, you know, 20 oxen with you? That's about a week-long journey on foot. You're going to bring 20 oxen, and you're going to bring a bunch of hay? Well, no, he'd say, you know, you could sell it, then you take the money, and when you get to Jerusalem, or wherever the tabernacle is, then you can buy some oxen and whatnot. In other words, he made provision for people so that it was doable. But when he makes those provisions that it would be doable, what does he expect of you to do? He expects you to do it, right? So he has a particular mode by which he wishes to be worshipped. And the Wild West, everybody does it the way they want to and where they want to and how they want to, was never acceptable to God. So we turn to the New Testament. And in the New Testament, what should we expect to see if we look at God's character? Should be the exact same thing, shouldn't it? We should expect that whatever way God wishes to be worshipped should be in an organized fashion. It should be uniform, meaning it's the same for all of us. And it should be something that's doable. And as you turn to the New Testament, that's exactly what you find. As we find a uniform system of worship that involves five acts. Now, the phrase five acts of worship never shows up in the New Testament. But if you look at all of the New Testament for all the acts of worship, guess what you end up with? Five. And so there's five different things that we see the New Testament church doing. And we find that all five of those things are doable by anybody. A cappella singing, right, where we just use our voices and make melody in our heart. Anybody can do that. Whereas if you say we're going to worship God with a band, with a guitar, a piano, or whatever, can everybody do that? You're going to run into quite a few people who are incapable of such a thing. They don't have the skill set to play an instrument. But everybody can do that. And then the other thing that we see that matches with those five is he gives us locations for those things and time. The Lord's Supper. What's the location for the Lord's Supper? Yeah, when you're assembled. That's it. It's when you're assembled together. Now, that's not the location for singing. Now, you can do it when you're assembled, but what's the location for singing? Turns out you can do that one anywhere. We see New Testament Christians singing all over the place, from Paul and Silas in prison. We see Jesus and his apostles right outside of the Garden of Gethsemane singing. And we see the saints all singing together when they're congregated together. But the Lord's Supper we see being something that's done when you assemble. And then it has a particular timing to it, which is the first day of the week. And we also see that with one other act, which is the giving. That's something done when on the first day of the week. And so this pattern of worship being the way God designed it is not a new one. That's what I want you to see out of chapter 12 as you go through it. The other thing that is interesting is that as you move through the chapter, and I'm not looking at a whole lot of specific verses in here, but look down at chapter 12 down in verse 19. He says, "Be careful that you do not forsake the Levite as long as you live in your land." One of the things that we find is that the Levites, who were the tribe that had no land of their own, they had cities to live in, but they had no land, they were wholly dependent on the faithfulness of the rest of the nation. If the rest of the nation is faithful and they give 10% to God, which was the minimum, by the way. That 10% wasn't wasn't the end of giving. That was actually the beginning. There was, you give your 10%, and then you had many other sacrifices and feasts and whatnot beyond that. But if everybody gave their 10%, of which that 10% was to be distributed to the Levites, well, how's the Levitical tribe going to do if everybody's giving their 10%? They're going to be totally fine. There's going to be no problem with it whatsoever. In fact, you could even just do it from a basic math standpoint. How many tribes are there? 12 tribes. So 10% of 11 of those tribes should be actually 110% of the needs of one tribe. Does that make sense? Because that one tribe, and Levi wasn't even the largest tribe. Not all the tribes are the same size. Like Judah was a particularly big tribe. Levi was much smaller. So 10% would have been more than sufficient. More than sufficient to meet all of the needs. But if they start to become less faithful, who gets neglected very clearly by that lack of faith? It's going to be the Levites. So here, when he says in verse 19, be careful you do not forsake the Levite as long as you live in your land, that idea is tied to, these things are connected. They're all interconnected, is his point, is that if you want, if you're faithful to me, the Levites will be in good shape. And the other side of it is, the Levites should, as a tribe, be very much dedicated to teaching and encouraging the people to be faithful to God. And if they're doing their job, then that actually kind of cycles itself back to them too, doesn't it? Whereas if the Levites are not particularly faithful and they become more idolatrous, I think in terms of like when you get further down in the Judges and you get to Eli, and Eli had two sons who were priests, and they were bogus. They're bad guys. In fact, people would come and bring their sacrifices and they'd stick their fork in and take the part that belonged to God. And they say, no, this is the tasty part. We'll take it first. Well, what do you think that did to the overall faithfulness of the nation when you have that sort of stumbling block at the top? You know, that would have driven people away from serving God. Well, the long-term effect on that is it actually takes the legs out from underneath the tribe of Levi as well. So God actually designed it that way to function under that method. So then we move into chapter 13. In chapter 13, he's going to talk here about false prophets, but along with false prophets, he'll also talk about those who would seduce you away from God. So the first group that would seduce you away from God is the prophet or the dreamer of dreams, is the way he'll describe him. If a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign of the wonder comes true concerning which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods whom you have not known, and let us serve them. So here, look at the definition real quick. This is somebody who comes up and they say they're a prophet, they say they've had a vision from God, and that prophecy or vision actually comes true. And accompanying whatever that is, they give you an instruction, and the instruction is, let's go up over here and follow false gods. Let's go do something that is contrary to what you can see in the scriptures that they had back then. He says, verse 3, you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God is testing you to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. When he says he's testing us to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, what commandment is that? That's the first and greatest commandment, right? So what's the test of that? When somebody seems quite believable, in this case, a prophet or a dreamer of dreams who seems to have all the right credentials, but they tell you something that is contrary to the Bible, that's a test. That's a test. Do you love God, or will you be seduced by that? And so in later parts, he'll give you another way to test prophets, and that is quite simply, if he says something will happen, and it doesn't happen, you know he's not a prophet. But here actually deals with another circumstance, which is he says he's a prophet. He gives you some sort of prophecy. What I think of in terms of this is probably someone like a Simon the Magician. You go to the book of Acts, you get to Acts chapter 8, and you have Simon the Magician who's performing these magical acts, and they were quite convincing, very, very convincing to everybody else, and they said, this man is the great power of God. Well, Simon was not from God, nor was he teaching things of God, so does it matter how great the magical act is? If he's teaching you something contrary to the Bible, doesn't matter what sort of sign they perform. So that's a test. So he lays that out, and then you get to verse 6. And by the way, he says that the end result is you should actually not listen to him, but you should put him to death. Then verse 6, he says, if your brother, your mother's son or daughter, or the wife you cherish, or your friend who is as your own soul. You think of this language is very similar to like David and Jonathan, right? So close to you. They entice you secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, whom neither you nor your fathers have known, of the gods of the people who are around you, near you, or far from you, from one end of the earth to the other end. You shall not yield to him or listen to him, and your eyes shall not pity him, nor shall you spare or conceal him, but you shall surely kill him. Your hand shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterwards the hands of all the people. So now here's this other seductive thing. We can kind of understand the false prophet who comes in with these convincing signs and the idea that he should be put to death. But now this test becomes actually a lot harder because this person who is seducing you to leave God at this point is somebody very, very close to you. The people that are described are the friend who is as your own soul, the wife that you cherish.
You have Job, and when Job was at his very lowest, what did his wife say to him?
Anybody remember?
Yeah, curse God and die. Right? Yeah, as far as we know, Job loved his wife, and she loved him. So it becomes particularly difficult temptation in those circumstances. And what they're told is to not yield to them, and in fact, don't even pity them. If they continue that course of action, if they're attempting to seduce you, you actually need to, that is, under the Jewish law, was a legal crime. Right? Today, it's not a crime in the U.S. to try and get somebody to leave the church and go to, you know, some other church. That's not a crime, so nothing happens. But it was then. It was part of their legal system. So he says, look, the punishment for that is stoning, and your hand should be the first against him. Well, in a stoning, the first person to throw the stone is who? Anybody remember? In stoning, what was the law? The Old Testament law says, who are the first people to throw the stones? The witnesses. That's right, it's the witnesses. So what he's saying is that if they do this, you need to be willing to testify in a court of law, yes, they did it. The same way that you would testify if your friend or the wife you cherished or your own son or daughter murdered somebody. You wouldn't like it. In fact, you'd probably be on the stand in tears. But if you knew they did it, what should you do? You'd have to testify, wouldn't you? And that's what he's asking him to do. So we cannot make any sort of false ideas in our mind as far as the relationship that we're to have between God and every human being in our life. It is as clear can be throughout the Old Testament and the New that it must always be God first and everybody else second. And there really is a reason. The first and greatest commandment is love the Lord your God, and the second is like it, but it's still the second, is love your neighbor as yourself. And so here, it doesn't matter how close the relationship, don't be seduced by them, and in fact, stand up against them. And that's a real good test of conviction, right? Conviction is when you will do something even though it harms you and is hard for you to do it. And it costs you something, like a friendship. I mean, you think about if the wife that you cherish, you end up having to be a witness against her in a case, what are the chances that relationship's going to be successful moving forward? That's not a likely positive outcome. And yet you need to be prepared to do it. So it is a matter of conviction. Then you go down to verse 12. He says, if you hear in one of your cities, which the Lord your God is giving you to live in, anyone saying that some worthless men have gone out from among you and have seduced the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods whom you have not known, then you shall investigate and search out and inquire thoroughly. And if it is true and the matter established that this abomination has been done among you, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it and all that is in it and its cattle with the edge of the sword. So now the other seductive practice is, what happens if a whole city, and this sort of thing can happen, are there cities in America that are just fundamentally different than the rest of America in terms of their ideals? Yeah. I mean, places like Las Vegas, San Francisco, Seattle, they just have a different view than the rest of the country. There can be pockets of, you say, well, they're just not like, their moral structure is very different. That happened in Israel too, and there are actual cases where, by the time we get to the book of Judges, where you have the Benjamites and whole cities where there were just major, major problems, problems that hearken back to the days of like Sodom and Gomorrah. And you say, well, what do you do? What do you do as a nation when you've all of a sudden got this one city that's rampant with idolatry and immorality? Well, in America, what would we do? We'd probably create an investigative board, and we'd probably throw some money at it, and we'd probably try and create a long-term, you know, plan of how we could all come to accept that they're different than us, and that's not what we see here. God's structure is actually quite plain. You go to war. You go to war against that city and you destroy it. And you raise it to the ground. And he makes a point that in verse 16, he says of that city, you're going to burn all of the plunder with fire. So there's not going to be any temptation if you do this to think, well, we could destroy it and then we could take all their stuff. No, everything gets destroyed the same way they're going to be required to do with places like Jericho. And then the city is going to be a ruin forever. It shall never be rebuilt. Which is quite the statement. Because if you go back to the land of Israel and any part of the ancient world there, that's all you do. Whenever you destroy a city, you rebuild right on top of it. And they call them tells, where you can... It's a big mound, and it's just one city's been built on another and another and another, typically because they're pretty good locations to build a city. That's why they, if you defeat them, you rebuild, is because that was a pretty good location. We should use it again. And here he's saying, no, that spot would never be rebuilt. And so we're laying out these ground rules of don't be seduced, no matter how close the person is, no matter how impressive they might seem in the case of the false prophet, or no matter how difficult and costly it would be to stand for truth. To destroy a whole city would be a very difficult thing to do, especially, I mean, you think about American Civil War and how hard that was on the country. When it was literally sometimes brother against brother. I mean, that's what he's telling them, is in that case, you would destroy the city even though they're your countrymen. So you get a clear picture of how God feels about these sorts of things. Anybody have any comments or questions on there on chapter 13? Okay, so chapter 14, he will talk about the clean and the unclean animal and the qualifications for those. Not going to spend a whole lot of time on that. We've already looked at that in previous books, as well as the fact that, practically speaking for us in the New Testament, all food has been made clean. The second aspect is the tithing, and this is where I mentioned a little bit already, where there's rules and regulations that they were to give their 10% and they were to bring it to the wherever the tabernacle was, but you could make it into money first. You could sell the goods, turn it into money, and then bring the money to contribute it that way. That would be just fine. So he lays those rules out as well. And then, let's see here, the only other thing is, down in verse 28, it says, at the end of every third year, you shall bring out all the tithe of your produce in that year, and shall deposit in your town the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance among you, and the alien, the orphan, the widower in your town shall come and eat and be satisfied, nor the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. One of the things that you'll see is that the tithing was part of a very large... This is a bit surprising for us because we don't tend to think of this in a good way, but a social welfare program that God had in the Old Testament. The social welfare program was, we do have a way of taking care of the poor. One of them will be mentioned actually in the next chapter, which is their a debt could only be held for up to 7 years. So you couldn't, somebody, if you're going to loan money to another Jew, you needed to know that he had 7 years to repay that, or if it wasn't repaid, then he was off the hook. So you didn't tend to loan him stuff that that you didn't think he could repay in that amount of time, because that turns out to be a bad deal for you. That was one. But here also with the tithing, we have a portion of it's to go to the people who are in need. The other one that was a major part of this, the social fabric of caring for the needy of society, was when you harvested, you didn't go back and make a second trip. So if you dropped something on the ground, that stayed there and any poor person could pick it up. That's what Ruth did. It's called gleaning. And then the other was that the edges of the fields were to be left untouched, and those could also be gleaned. What's interesting is that God made very clear provisions for the poor, but those provisions were all to be made by faithful people individually fulfilling God's word. It's a collective command to the nation, but it only succeeds if individuals are doing their job. And that's a good model for us as Christians, is that we should look and say, do I have a responsibility to the poor? Yes. Is the federal government the best way to take care of that? I don't really see that model. What I see the model in is God commanding individuals, this is how you can help those who are in need. And when individuals fulfill that command that's given collectively to them, but they do it individually, it works out quite nicely. And you get beautiful stories like Ruth out of that. I mean, Ruth is the story of two poor women who survived based off of the kindness of a man named Boaz, who was allowing Ruth to glean in the fields because that was God's command, and he was faithful to God. So, you know, just something to look at there. God does very much care about the poor and impoverished and the needy, but he the way he does it is quite different than what we see models typically today. Chapter 15, that's that year of release that I just mentioned, where you can be released from debt. And then also, down in verse 12, he says, if your kinsman, a Hebrew man or woman, is sold to you, then he shall serve you 6 years, but in the seventh year you shall set him free. When you set him free, you shall not send him away empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally from your flock and from your threshing floor and from your wine vat. You shall give to him as the Lord your God has blessed you. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this today. So, slavery is a very ugly word to us as Americans because it's connected to a very ugly part of our history. And so when you talk about slavery, it has a tone to it that doesn't sound good at all to us for obvious reasons. But under the Old Testament law, it was their bankruptcy system. You know, today you file for bankruptcy if your debts are too high and there's a legal process you go through. And it's not an easy process. You know, sometimes people say, oh, I declare bankruptcy and that was easy. Well, People who've actually had to do that will tell you it's not easy, but it is also different than what you see in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, there was no way to declare bankruptcy. What you could do if you couldn't pay is you could sell yourself into slavery. You could make an agreement with somebody and that you would serve as their slave to pay off the debt. Well, here in chapter 15, what we have is this detail that tells us the longest you could have a Hebrew man or woman as a slave was 6 years. So it was never meant as a lifetime of slavery. Now, foreign slaves, ones that were gained oftentimes through war, was allowed to be longer in that case. But your fellow countrymen, it was 6 years. That was the most. And when he left, you weren't just to shove him out on the street, but you're actually to furnish him with enough to kind of get started with his life again. So it was a system that was really doesn't in any way resemble what we think of as slavery at all. So you have a system God had in place for when somebody got too far in debt and they were unable to pay. There was a way out of that, but it was a manageable system. Not an easy system. I think back then, if you could ask somebody, would you rather be free or a slave, the vast majority of people would rather be free. But it was a manageable thing. And I will say that there are cases where there were people who did prefer to be a slave, and that is the one exception to the six-year rule. To a Hebrew slave who was only allowed to be a slave for 6 years, but if at the end of those 6 years he wanted to remain a slave because he liked the arrangement so well, he was to go up to the doorpost and they were supposed to drive an awl through his ear, and he's going to have an earring that would testify the fact that he was a slave by choice for the rest of his life to whoever his master was, because the arrangement was positive. So that did happen. Like I said, it resembles very little what we think of in terms of American picture of slavery. Does anybody have any comments or questions there on chapter 15? Okay, so then we move to chapter 16, and we're reintroduced to the three major feasts: the Feast of the Passover, the Feast of Weeks, which will later on be known as Pentecost, and the Feast of Booths. And what we're reminded of with each of these three feasts is that these three feasts, there were other ones as well, but these particular ones, they happen at a certain time of year, every year, and all adult males had to present themselves at the tabernacle. You would often find they would bring their families and whatnot, but they had to at least, the men had to present themselves before God at these particular times. This chapter also includes the beginnings of, if it were me, I would have put the chapter marker from chapter 16 to 17 at a different spot. I would start chapter 17 at 16, 18. Because at that point, he's going to start talking about judges and justice and judgment. And that's a kind of a separate topic from the different feasts. Because chapter 17 will essentially be focused on what is God's system for them as a society to have justice. Because anytime you have a society, you have to figure out what are the laws, and then you have to figure out who's in charge of administering those laws and agreeing who's broken them and who hasn't, and then what's the punishment. Because that's the only way you have a rule of law. If you let's imagine all of a sudden we made a new law in America tomorrow, but it's in a book somewhere and no police officer ever enforces it. Well, is it actually really an effective law at that point? It can't be. And in fact, we do have laws in America that are that way, where the police are told don't enforce that thing. Well, then that law has no impact whatsoever. So you need to have a law, and then you have to have people who actually enforce it, whether it be police officers or judges or a combination thereof. And so that's what he talks about starting in chapter 16, verse 18. He says, you shall appoint for yourself judges and officers in all your towns, which the Lord your God is giving you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. So you're going to have a structure where there, at every town there are people who are enforcing the laws. And then as you progress out and you get to the nation, eventually you'll get, you know, just like we had with Moses. Moses was the final voice of judgment on things, and there were other people underneath him. That's the way the nation's going to run as a whole from that point forward, is that each town had different judges and officers, and then tribes would have those and so forth if the problem were more complicated. Similar to how we would see our legal court system today, where you have local courts and then you can go, of course, all the way up to the Supreme Court. So, any questions on that? I know that some of this stuff is a little bit of the dryer, so I'm trying to cover it a little faster than other sections. Chapter 17, verse 7, is where it specifically says, the hand of the witnesses shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people, so you shall purge the evil from your midst. Here is in describing another person who has sinned and they've transgressed the covenant and they're idolatrous. And once again, it starts out with you'll inquire thoroughly, and then the witnesses are the first ones to cast a stone. How many witnesses are you going to need? You're going to need two or three, right? If you don't have two or three, then it doesn't pass the test. When you turn to the New Testament and Jesus is there with the adulterous woman who the crowd said was caught in the very act, anybody remember what Jesus said? You without sin cast the first stone. And everybody left. That's what he's referring to there. He's saying, okay, if she was caught in the very act, show me the witnesses. Show me the people without sin in this who can be witnesses to it. And they all left because he knew the law. He knew that there were no witnesses to cast the first stone. And probably one of the things that tipped him off is if she was caught in the very act, who should have also been there? It should have been the guy, too. We don't just stone the women. So you have a very clear case there where Jesus knew the law better than these people who are trying to entrap him. So he wasn't saying don't obey the law. He's actually saying, well, look, what does the law say? Give her her fair day in court. And what you're doing is not a fair day in court. You just brought her out to me and said, hey, we should stone this gal. That's not how that works. You do a fair inquiry. Everybody gets their day in court. Then chapter 17, he will talk about when they get a king. Now, verse 14, he says, when you're in the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me. Now, what we'll find when they actually do that is, and it does actually get to the point where they want to have a king, who will be their first king? Saul, that's right. Saul will be the first king. When they say, give us a king so we can be like the other nations, was that a good request or a bad request? It's a bad request. So the short version is, you shouldn't even do this. But God, knowing their hearts and having wisdom, wisdom's the ability to look ahead, God's got a lot of that. He saw there would come a day where they would get settled and they would want to have somebody so that they look like the other nations. And verse 15 says, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your countrymen you shall set as king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. So you're going to have a king, but God will choose him. He shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. He shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away. Who's that remind you of? Solomon. When Solomon did all of those things, multiplying horses, his first wife came from, anybody know? Egypt. Yeah, his first wife came from Egypt. And then he had many wives. What did it do to his heart? Turned it away. It was all prophesied ahead. God gave them all the warnings. I've set before you both blessing and curse. So you have this this structure here that of what would happen and foreshadowing of it long before it actually occurred. And so God knew. That's the point. And as we move through Deuteronomy, what you're seeing is not just God preparing them to be successful, but God understanding that they probably wouldn't. I mean, that they would have choices, and what is the tendency of human beings over time to choose? And we mess up. Yeah, we don't choose as we ought to. And so God understood that that would be a problem they would face in the future, and he tried to prepare them for it. So that's we're at time. We'll stop there. Any comments or questions before we close out? Okay, we'll pick up in chapter 18 next week.